Hello and welcome to Literary Loitering, part of the Geek Show Podcast Network. This is our dedicated books podcast. I'm Graham and today I've been joined by...
You want us to say our names, don't you?
That's the plan. That's how it should go.
That only took an uncomfortably long pause to figure out. I'm Andrew.
And I'm Rob. See, I was waiting for you to say my name, but I was all ready to say hello, and then you threw me.
We don't really do the everyone says their own name thing on this podcast, don't we? But no. We should.
No.
It lets the listeners know who we are.
Say my name, goddammit, Graham.
Rob!
I wanted to say that to someone for years, and I just never thought it'd be on this. Oh, it's all going wrong already.
Right, so should we go straight into the news?
Without even a date in a movie first.
That's the Cinema Eclectica podcast you're thinking of.
You're right, it all blurs into one.
Plugs.
I'm worried about that last statement, Graham.
That we regularly go on dates with each other. What's your problem with us being a polyamorous podcast, Rob?
It's the plugs that I'm worried about.
Andrew, jump in and save us.
It's fine. Rob's too caught up in the old world. He doesn't know how modern things are. He's not hip to the SJW crowd. He doesn't listen to St. Vincent.
I feel uncomfortably defined by this hipster caricature you're painting.
Feel free to deny any part of it that isn't true.
Don't worry, I will, as soon as it comes up.
Hey, should we have some news?
Yeah.
Let's do newses.
So, in other news of places finally getting with the liberal agenda, that works as a segue, that's great. Students in the junior high school of Biloxi, Mississippi, that's not a place name, America. But yep, students in this school that apparently definitely exists in a real place are going to be allowed to read Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird.
Finally!
As long as they have a note from their parents saying it's okay. Apparently, the book was part of the curriculum, but then was pulled after parents complained that the language in the book makes people uncomfortable, which, yes, well done. You've hit upon one of the themes of To Kill a Mockingbird.
When you think about it, it shouldn't be possible for a work of fiction to generate as much controversy as To Kill a Mockingbird has over the decades.
Especially when its message, its stance on racism is, I think, pretty clear, namely that it's bad.
Yeah. I mean, it's stated as much in the book. Mockingbirds do nothing but sing, so it's a sin to kill one.
Do we think that maybe the parents were offended by the implication that birds that don't sing should be killed on sight?
Or maybe they just have a taste for mockingbird stew.
Maybe that's it.
And this is Mississippi we're talking about.
Seeing as it is Mississippi we're talking about, maybe they were offended that the book was too critical of racism.
I mean, to be fair to the school, the main reason they banned it is because children being basically just amorphous lumps of everything that is wrong with humankind kept laughing out loud at any mention of the N-word.
Oh God, they probably thought it was an edgy 4chan meme, didn't they?
I've heard To Kill a Mockingbird described as many things, but never that.
Fine, we'll just slap an image of Pepe the Frog on the front.
Oh.
I suppose it is about false rape allegations, which, according to 4chan, is the human rights crisis of our time. So maybe To Kill a Mockingbird is going to be the thing that finally builds that bridge.
Yay, we finally have that link between classic literature and dank memes.
Yeah.
I know, that's what I've been waiting for all my life.
In retrospect, you're right, I don't want to build that bridge. Let's blow it up, bridge on the River Kwai style.
Yeah, I was about to say, I don't want that bridge building either, because we finally got a chance to get rid of Harvey Weinstein.
That's true. That's been quite refreshing, hasn't it? For a while he looked like this unmovable lump corrupting film culture, and now he's dead. I haven't checked. He's dead, right?
He's still alive.
Probably.
He's still very much alive and getting therapy, apparently.
Ah, that famous stop being a rapist therapy. How's that going?
I don't know. Maybe he used Therapist Finder.
Maybe it's a rigorous program where if you haven't raped anyone by the end of the second week, you're basically not a rapist.
Graham didn't even see what I did there. None of you saw the joke I made.
I've just seen it now. You've pointed out it's one of those power genitalia things, isn't it?
No, Therapist Finder is literally the words, the Rapist Finder.
Oh, yeah, that's why I said it's one of those. PowerGen set up an Italian site that was called PowerGen Italia without realising the URL spells out Power Genitalia.
Yes, I didn't see that. Okay.
Now, when even...
Tobias Funke is going to be the first man to combine analysis and therapy.
Oh, no.
Become an analyst.
We're talking a lot about rape, which, to be fair, when you're dealing with current affairs, it is basically an ongoing list of who's a really terrible person now. But
it's everyone!
Yes, including me. I'm awful.
Yes.
However, let's go to a subject that has absolutely nothing to do with sexual assault at all.
Oh, good. Can I stop pretending that Biloxi, Mississippi exists as well?
It doesn't. It's just a myth.
Yes, you can. Yes, you can.
Let us now go to what our lawyers tell us is the completely unrelated subject of Donald Trump. A new short sketch has been unearthed, written by Harold Pinter, about a gung-ho American president launching a nuclear attack. He launches it on London without congressional approval, and then says that he would like double Jack Daniels on the rocks, but he gave up booze for religious reasons, which suggests that it may actually be about George W. Bush, who was a teetotaler for religious reasons. Still.
What? You think Harold Pinter might have written a sketch about the president who was actually in office at the time, not the one who would be in office 2 decades later? And is Harold Pinter dead?
He kind of is, yes.
How is he kind of dead?
It's like the Princess Bride. He's only mostly dead.
So, hang on.
But yes, the president in power 2 decades later and after his own death.
So, you know, there's some scepticism in the room. I'm feeling that.
No, I'm just thinking, was Harold Pinter secretly Nostradamus? Did he change his name or something like that?
I mean, we've never analysed Pinter's plays from that standpoint, have we? I'm sure, given the right examination, No Man's Land might actually be about the rise of Jeremy Corbyn. It makes about as much sense as anything else in the play.
No, I think it was talking about the Conservative Party. Because I'm sure there's not a testicle among them.
But this is, I mean, it's not really that much of a news flash to say that Harold Pinter was not that fond of Republicans, since he spent much of his last decade or so of life writing about how dreadful they were. But this is a nice surprise.
Yes, for certain definitions of surprise.
Yeah, it's not that nice either, really, isn't it? It's about nuclear devastation. It's not nice and it's not a surprise. Other than that, I stand by my original statement.
Fair enough.
Pinter has a bit of form writing sketches, although he is often thought of as a serious playwright. Peter Cook once claimed that during his apprenticeship writing sketches for Kenneth Williams's... Frankie Howard's stage plays. He complained that there was one young writer who realised that they were being paid according to the amount of time their sketches lasted for in total, and kept on putting really long pauses in all of the sketches, and that was Harold Pinter.
Was it?
Yes.
Okay.
That's where it comes from.
Ah. Well, that explains a lot.
Yeah. We are doing some Pinter-esque pauses of our own here, aren't we?
Yes, we are. Still trying to puzzle my way through.
I was wondering which one of you was going to ruin it first.
It's just lost all of the subtlety of the master's technique now we're talking.
And also, there's the very good point that we don't get paid by the length of our podcast. Mainly because we don't get paid at all.
No.
This is true.
So I think that's a wrap for today's show. Thanks for listening, everyone. Bye.
But we haven't talked about Cambridge decolonising the English syllabus.
Oh, finally. I'm sick of Cambridge colonising the English syllabus. I'm happy that they're finally retreating. That is what this story's about, right?
Not quite.
Yeah, they're just planting tiny flags on copies of Lord of the Flies.
A group of academics at the University of Cambridge is considering how to implement a call from undergraduates to decolonise its English literature syllabus by taking in more black and minority ethnic writers and bringing post-colonial thought to its existing curriculum. So, according to this, Cambridge University has been teaching English literature without any post-colonial thought whatsoever. And when did the empire officially end?
Yeah, you'd think everything's kind of post-colonial by default now, unless you live on Gibraltar or somewhere.
Or study at Cambridge University.
Apparently, yes.
Yeah, I don't know. An English Lit syllabus focusing entirely on what we consider to be classic works, even though they may no longer have any real relevance in the modern world. That's a shocker to me, all right. As someone who has taken literally English literature at any level from primary school upwards.
You're saying that your primary school literature course was not big on the works of Don DeLillo?
Surprisingly, no. That was my main critique of them.
The Daily Telegraph has reported on this in about as rubbish a way as you would expect from a modern conservative newspaper, to be honest. They did a front cover story with a big photo of one of the students who was leading the campaign with the headline, "Student Forces Cambridge to Drop White Authors." They then published a corrections and clarification piece which ends with, "The proposals were in fact recommendations. Neither they nor the open letter called for the university to replace white authors with black ones, and there were no plans to do so." So, yes, other
than... Next up, are millennials killing racism?
As other than every single thing being wrong, that was right, apparently. Not my favourite correction, though.
Sorry, I've just seen a hilarious thing. Apparently, according to Trump, the Civil War is just getting started.
Clearly, this is part of the problem. If he'd read post-Civil War literature, he'd know that it was actually over.
Yeah, and so is Civil War too.
Yes.
I bet Trump sided with Captain Marvel.
Possibly he did. We don't know. We don't
That's
know.
Right. I've brought comics into this now. Just like I do on our great comics podcast 4 panel, I can do plugs as well.
Hang on a moment. You do a podcast where you talk about the subject of a podcast. Why have we not done this before?
That's... I think we have a new Geek Show podcast.
All I can say is maybe Donald should have read the book called Lessons from America's Philosopher-in-Chief.
I thought he would have done that, what with being so interested in philosophy.
Well, it's the full title is The Art of the Donald, Lessons from America's Philosopher-in-Chief. And he actually tweeted out that the author was highly respected and came out with this book. And, you know, there were lessons to be learned. It was a really good book, but he hadn't actually read it.
Right.
So I think maybe if he'd read it, he might have found that it wasn't quite as flattering towards the Donald as he might have thought.
The giveaway, of course, is that it was a book.
Yes, that is a dead giveaway.
You know, I can't remember what it was we were talking about before Rob abruptly shoved this conversation in, so I'm just going to have to agree with his point.
That's fair.
So is there anything else been happening?
In the world?
No, just in like the arts world, books world, things like that.
Ah, that's narrowed it down. That's fine.
Okay, good. I was going to say, I can talk about the fact that I saw the new Thor film.
Yeah. We can talk about a hypothetical future film, maybe. Eh? Hmm? Mm. Eh?
Okay.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
I could talk about the pulled pork sandwich I had.
Let's talk about that film. There's a new adaptation of James Frey's A Million Little Pieces in production, which is quite surprising, since A Million Little Pieces is balls.
Is what?
Is balls.
Are we talking like balls as in literally bouncing balls type thing, or balls as in it's rubbish?
It's rubbish, but not just in the Morrissey's novel way that we often talk about, you know, novels being rubbish. This is literally, factually inaccurate garbage. It was written as a novel by Frey before one of his editors told him that his harrowing memoir of drug addiction would be better published as, well, as a memoir, as non-fiction, despite that tiny hurdle where it wasn't actually true. And after it was published in 2006 and became one of Oprah's book club selections, people on the legal website Smoking Gun started going through the records and revealed it to be riddled with untruths and embarrassingly adolescent exaggerations to make James Frey look really cool and hard. And a planned feature film version produced by Tom Hanks went into turnaround. But now, maybe this is still Trump news, Sam Taylor Johnson has decided that the world is ready for a true story that is complete nonsense and contains no truth.
Yeah, but when has that ever stopped Hollywood before? I mean, the words based on a true story cover a lot of ground.
Yes, maybe they're going to pitch it as being like Fargo.
Yeah, or maybe they'll just rebrand the memoir so it's a memoir that's based on a true story.
Yes, yeah, because certainly nobody would deny that James Frey exists.
I know. I think I'd deny it. If he said he knew me, I would definitely deny that.
I mean, I would check it, given his past form.
I mean, I think the thing is, you got to live your truth, you know? like, who are other people to tell you what's real? Do they really have the right to say, you can't write a memoir about your time as a drug addict just because you've never actually been a drug addict? That's capitalist thinking is what it is. It's the bourgeois intelligentsia. It's going to keep you down.
Are these lessons from the philosopher-in-chief?
Or are you trying to give me a segue opportunity? Because it's failing. I'm not good at it.
What I'm doing is that thing I sometimes do where I open my mouth and then words just start coming out and I don't really know where the words are going, and then they just pile up and pile up until I hit something.
You have given me
it's a fiery wreck, and now we're in a metaphor.
It's terrible to be trapped in a metaphor, isn't it?
Yes.
It is. I mean, I feel like that there's something I should be able to compare it to, but I just can't think of anything.
Well, while you have a think about what a thing is, which is a profitable occupation, should we talk about some communism?
Yeah, let's.
Please, yes.
Yeah. Back on subjects Andrew understands, the big filthy commie.
Andrew is, yes, the Red Menace.
He is. He is the fifth column.
Proletariat. That's a communist word.
It's a communist word, and it's something that the communists like, so it works in context. If you'd said bourgeoisie, that would have been embarrassing.
Yeah. I have to admit, though...
I would have to turn in my beret.
I have to admit, yes. Proletariat does sound like a suppository.
Thanks, Rob.
Lowering the tone since 1975.
Yes, the historian, and as I read this name, I realise I immediately regret suggesting this as a story we can cover, but here we go anyway.
Oh, this should be good.
The historian Yuri Slezkine.
So what was that?
Don't. The historian Yuri Slezkine has researched Moscow's unimaginatively named, I think, House of Government. It's no Biloxi, Mississippi, is it?
But nothing is. Not even Biloxi, Mississippi.
Hang on. Wasn't there a film called Biloxi Blues?
I think there was. Didn't it star Elvis?
I think so. Yeah. Did they have the blues because they couldn't find this mythical place called Biloxi?
They had the blues because they realised they were living in the most non-existent sounding town in the world, even more than Ouagadougou.
Or there was an amazing party they were invited to in Biloxi, but they couldn't find it.
A tragedy for our times.
I feel like I maybe shouldn't be making all these comments when I live in a country that has a town called Cockermouth.
Was it you I was talking to about Cockermouth recently?
It was me who was talking to about Cockermouth. I was
definitely talking about Cockermouth to somebody, and it's, you know, it's not a regular occurrence. It tends to lodge in the mind.
Not saying anything.
What are those wacky communists up to?
Well, they're up to the wackiest thing that a wacky communist can possibly do, which is not being that communist. Apparently, Slezkine conducted dozens of interviews with residents of the House of Government, delved through archived diaries and letters, and found that rather than a non-stop diary of Marx and Engels, the children of the Bolsheviks were reading Dickens, Defoe, Shakespeare and Balzac.
Okay.
There's actually some rather remarkable names in here. That old arch-imperialist Rudyard Kipling was quite hot among Marxists. Oscar Wilde, too, who rumour has it was a bit decadent. This story's clearly inaccurate. Dickens, he said, was everyone's favourite writer. Not mine.
Nope, not mine either.
I don't hate him.
I've read a Dickens book, so definitely not mine.
Yeah.
I think I still have a dent in my forehead from the amount of time Oliver Twist hit me as I fell asleep reading it.
The thing that I hate most about Dickens is that he wants to be taken very seriously as a social critic while also having loads of characters called stupid things like Mr. Drivel Balls or something. Yes.
Not sure about the name Drivel Balls, though.
Yeah, I might have made that up a bit.
But more importantly, you also might not have, and it's impossible to tell.
This is true. Don't forget, a lot of authors use pen names.
Yes.
Who knows what their real name is?
It sounds to me like communists could do with having their canon decolonized a bit.
Again, just checking, because we are talking about communists, and which means Russia and China generally.
Mm.
When you say canon, you're talking about not the weapon, right?
That would be interesting if young communists were reading a massive gun.
It's just, they have a tendency to parade their weaponry around.
Mm.
Yeah, I've seen their parades. So when you say decolonizing their cannon...
I don't think it's not the communists who are the ones doing the parades.
But it happens in communist countries.
It does happen a lot in communist countries. But, you know, it happens less in the ones that read more. there is no, as far as I'm aware, great North Korean literary canon. Whereas Russians have a few authors who are quite good. I mean, that Dostoevsky fella, a lot of literary critics say he's done some good page turners.
He has.
Yeah, but it's page turners in the sense that you're flicking through. Jesus Christ, it's how long?
What country was Nabokov from?
He was a Russian emigre. I'm starting to maybe see the problem in that quite a lot of the greatest Russian writers were actually really anti-communist.
Yes.
Yeah, Nabokov was. Dostoevsky wrote The Possessed, which is very critical of young revolutionaries. Mikhail Bulgakov was thought of as the model communist writer until people actually read The Master and Margarita,
I'm detecting a lot from today, because we had Trump with the philosophy of the and I'm detecting a lot of kind of born in the USA type things going on. You know, the story about how the American military wanted to use that as their anthem until they actually listened to it.
Yes, and it's always a great pleasure when that happens. By the way, you know how I mentioned earlier that Telegraph thing was my second favourite correction recently.
Yes.
And you thought we were going to let you say what your first was. Well, surprise! We're not. Moving on.
We don't have anything to move on to, fools. You're my prisoners now. Yes.
So you didn't say that in the right voice.
What is there a right voice for that?
Papa Lazaru.
Hello, Dave! I once sat in a Burger King next to someone who had that exact voice.
Right, fine, that's broken me. Tell your Telegraph anecdote.
It's not from the Telegraph, actually. It's from the New York Times, but it is a pretty amazing correction. Because of an editing error, an article on Monday about a theological battle being fought by Muslim imams and scholars in the West against the Islamic State misstated the Snapchat handle used by Sahib Webb, one of the Muslim leaders speaking
out.
This one. It is Imam Sahib Webb, not Pimpin' for Paradise 786.
Oh, of course I know this one, because I saw it on your Facebook feed. I've solved the mystery.
Pimpin' for Paradise. It's just brilliant.
Also the title of my autobiography.
Sorry, that caught me off guard. I didn't expect that.
I don't think it's possible to expect that.
That's a hell of a correction. And you honestly have to question, how did they get that wrong?
Clearly, they'd found a Snapchat conversation between Imam Sahib Webb and their reporter, and their reporter's Snapchat handle must be Pimpin' for Paradise, I guess.
How would you look at that and not think, I might have got the names wrong a bit?
I mean, think about it, right? They're interested in the guy called Imam Sahib. So surely the one that's called Imam Sahib Webb would be the Snapchat you focus on.
No, it's too obvious. He's obviously using the pseudonym Pimpin' for Paradise.
It's just like, if you see one called Imam Sahib Webb, it's so plain that you just think, is this some kind of weird Twitter joke that I'm not familiar with? It's too normal. It's got to be Pimpin' for Paradise.
Maybe it's a double bluff.
Also, I want an investigation launched immediately into all 786 other Pimpin' for Paradises.
Yes. That's a lot of people Pimpin' for Paradise. You'd think they'd have got there by now.
That's the mystery.
This is true. Shall we take a break there?
Let's.
The world of comics and manga are much, much more complex than I'll ever know. So tune in to 4Panel on the Geek Show Podcast Network to make that whole world a little less intimidating.
welcome back to the show. Now Rob is going to talk about a book, and it's a book that he's read and I definitely haven't not read because I was too lazy to, and then gave back to Rob to read while I had a nap.
Yes, it's definitely not that book. This is The Lazarus Gate by Mark A. Latham, which leads me to think there is another person who writes called Mark Latham. And according to George Mann, it is steeped in rich fantasy and Victorian authenticity and is not to be missed. It has a bunch of plaudits. And
some of them even by better authors.
Yes, like James Lovegrove and so. And it's out already from Titan Books. This is actually a trilogy of books, but this is just the first one I'm covering today. I'll cover the other two in upcoming shows. But this starts off in Myanmar, and it's mainly about a character called Captain John Hardwick, who is part of the British Army and, sorry, not Myanmar, at the time it was called Burma. So he's been captured by the Burmese rebels and he's been held
to... God damn it, Rob. You maybe have to suppress an Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt reference for nothing.
Oh, what?
I was desperately trying not to burst into Pinot Noir.
Anyway, he's been held captive and tortured for 6 months and now he's been released under very, very unusual circumstances. Nobody's sure what's going on. And so he is on his way home back to the UK. And he doesn't know what's going on, but things have been happening back in Old Limey. There have been terrorist attacks by a group called the Dynamiters, and somehow they may or may not be related to what's going on in Ireland at the time. John is then recruited to try and find out what's going on by a group called the Apollonians, which is led by a gentleman called Sir Toby Fitzgerald Bart. And the Bart is after a comma. And the first thing that puzzled me about that name is, what the hell is Bart?
Is he a baronet?
Possibly.
Ooh.
Is that what Bart means in that situation?
I think so.
Because I was reading it, I was thinking Bart Simpson.
Yes. I'm not a poshness expert, yeah. But...
Now, this is essentially a detective thriller set in Victorian London, with magic and stuff thrown in, right? And I'll be honest, I quite liked it. There are bits that aren't very good, let's be honest. You know, there are bits that are quite bland. There are sections of the story where it just... I think Andrew summed it up best when I was talking to him about it before. It tells you a lot, but doesn't show you a lot.
Yeah, Which is something I knew despite having definitely never read half this book before.
You know, and that is kind of annoying. And the reason why it does that, why it tells you a lot, is because it's written in first person perspective. And I think for this type of book, it might have been better written as a third person book. So the author is basically telling a story and so showing things that happen rather than telling people that these things are happening, which is the inherent problem.
Definitely.
You know, it's the inherent problem with first person perspective. Is that you tell people, you don't show them.
Yeah, like, that was especially bad with some of his backstory as well.
Yeah, it was.
A lot of it was just, gosh, the stuff that happened in Burma sure was bad.
Yeah, I like the character. Yes, as Andrew says, there are those issues. But on the whole, I do actually like John Hardwick as a character. You know, he's one of those characters who is very British, stiff upper lip, but has actually got a lot of trauma. I've seen him described on the back of this. In fact, it describes him as an army veteran and opium addict. And the irony of that statement is that he is, his opium addiction was not something he wanted. It was kind of forced on him during torture.
I thought you were going to say it was just something he stumbled into by accident there.
You know, he was playing around recreational drugs, you know. Went on a slide and ended up in a bag full of needles and, you know, the rest is history. No, it didn't happen like that. So, yeah, it's the result of his torture, which is why he's an opium addict and he hates the fact that he's an opium addict. Yeah, it adds a little bit of colour to his character and that's, again, the problem with the perspective is that, as Andrew says, oh, that stuff that happened to me in Burma was pretty bad, wasn't it?
Yes.
Oh, I'm having flashbacks of that stuff that happened to me in Burma. pretty bad, isn't it?
Yes, and you know it's bad because I'm telling you it's bad.
Oh, look, these scars on my body have come from the stuff that happened to me in Burma. Pretty bad, isn't it?
It's rough. Nobody's saying it's not rough.
Yeah. This is the thing. I like the character, but that kind of minimizes the character a bit. It kind of makes him less than he actually is. But the main meat of the book is actually the mystery, is actually the detectiveness, the going around searching for clues, putting pieces of the puzzle together. There's certain elements of kind of the veterinary Vimes relationship going on in this book, in parts between Satobi and John Hardwick. Because Satobi is kind of the veterinary character and he's got his clerks who basically run around and do all the shadowy corners and do all this work overnight. And then John Hardwick gets the results the next day. It's a bit like the back computer in the old 60s ones where you just put something in, press a couple of buttons and, you know, all of a sudden you got shark repellent.
Like Adam West's Batman.
Yeah.
Nice.
So there are elements of that, but I'll be honest, on the whole, I like the setting. I like the descriptive nature of the setting a lot. And having lived in London, I know where most of these places are, so I know it's actually pretty accurate in its description of various things, you know, various places and their location to each other, which added a nice touch for me because I've walked around those places countless times in the past. And the other thing I liked about
it, of course, because Rob is so old, it was in the Victorian era.
No, it wasn't. No, it wasn't, thankfully. But yeah, this is in the Victorian era, and so it does have a lot of the motifs of the Victorian period. It has an amazing character in the form of a guy called Ambrose, who is a lovable rogue, as John Hardwick describes him. And he lives up to that in quite a lot of ways.
I remember just like a really great line where it's something like, I'll steal, seduce, and drink anything for the nation.
Yep.
And often the last two just for myself.
That is pretty much the line verbatim. Ambrose he's everything kind of you want. He's kind of the Han Solo of this book to John Hardwick's Luke Skywalker. Hardwick is very much the straight-laced, you know, go by the rules and do everything in a methodical way, whereas Ambrose is fly by the seat of your pants, privateer type character. So you know Ambrose is the one who's going to get the girl in the end, and you know John Hardwick is going to be left with the opium addiction and the trauma from being tortured in Burma. But the two of them make a nice kind of double act for a good portion of the book. They work well together, and when it gets to the more magical things later on, when they start getting into that sort of territory, it meshes together quite well because the Victorians were really fascinated by magic. And Mark A. Latham has picked up on that fact and used it to his advantage when it's come to writing this. It's not the best detective thriller fantasy involving magic, stuff like that, that I've read. That's set in Victorian London.
I mean, I know you've read quite a lot of them, but that sounds harsher than you probably meant it.
Yeah, it does sound harsher than I meant it. It's not the best one that I've read, but it is very good. And if you're after something that is a little bit different to the usual fare, then give it a go. It is already out, and it's well worth a look if you're into your Victorian period detective thrillers. Or Victorian period magical thrillers, that sort of thing. It's a blend of the two.
Read, like the other 9,000 that exist.
Yeah, the other 9,000 that exist. This is one of the better ones by a long way, I'd say. It's a lot better than some of the drivel that I've read. I'll say this for Mark Latham: the language is pretty good overall.
It's just a shame that Mark A. Latham can't live up to those standards.
Sorry, Mark A. Latham. Yeah, the language is pretty good. Mark A. Latham has done a pretty good job with the language. Thank you for correcting me sarcastically there, Andrew.
I mean, it's absolutely the one thing I'm good for.
This is true. But yeah, the book isn't as enjoyable to read in terms of the language as A Natural History of Dragons, which is an absolute joy to read because you just love reading it and trying to tangle your tongue around some of the words that Marie Brennan brings up. This isn't as enjoyable as that book, in terms of its language, but it is still up there. It does still use a lot of Victorian slang, especially the whole thing with the taxi, which they call the Growler.
Not this again.
Yes, this again.
Why does every single podcast we do end up in a morass of Growler discussion?
Because he catches a Growler and rides into Bloomsbury.
No.
Could also be because we're all incredibly childish.
Well, yes.
I very nearly burst out laughing at just the name Balzac.
So, yeah. The Lazarus Gate, it's worth a read.
Nice.
And I'll have the next book in the trilogy for the next show.
That's quite prompt, better than I often do.
And on similar terms, Rob, I'll be able to give you back the second book in the Natural History of Dragons series soon.
Have you finished it?
Because I've actually... Whoa. I've gotten around to reading it and have nearly finished it. And it's only taken me like a year.
Yes. Ah, I don't know what to say to that. Except that's about it for today, isn't it?
Hopefully.
Literary Loitering is part of the Geek Show Podcast Network. All of our shows are available on Apple Podcasts and Audio Boom. So if you're listening through any of those services or other podcast providers, then subscribe. It'll keep you up to date with all the shows on our network, some of which have been mentioned during the course of this show.
Getting that marketing synergy going.
Yes. We are also on Patreon. If you're a regular listener, then subscribe. It keeps us running and allows us to buy new equipment, which will help get rid of annoying echoes, hopefully. And if you want to get in touch with us, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter or email us studio@thegeekshow.co.uk. And that's about it for this week. We'll see you in a couple of weeks with more books and art and books and stuff. Until then, I've been Rob.
And books.
Yes.
I'm Graham.
And I'm Andrew.
We'll see you all later.
Thanks for listening. It was a really good pulled pork sandwich, though.